All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this short course about quantum information at Perimeter Institute. Well, we are all delocalized here. I am in Boston right now, and I will have the pleasure to show you some stuff about quantum information and quantum thermodynamics. So before we start, this is the morning session. The way this thing works is that I'm gonna lecture for say 45 to 50 minutes, something like that. And then you will have additional 45, 50 minutes divided in smaller groups in some Zoom break rooms. And during this second part, you will be working on some problems that I will say during the lecture. And Beata, who is here with us today and is helping me running this course, and I will be jumping from room to room to help you out with these problems. But the premise is that you're kind of, you know, getting clarifications and hints, because these problems require more than 45 minutes to complete. So the premise is that you guys should find a way of meeting with your own group using either Slack, you're all being added to Slack, or Zoom, or whatever virtual venue you can come up with, and you know, complete the problems on your own, and then we can talk about that again in the next lecture on Wednesday. Okay, so this is how this thing works. People in the afternoon will watch the recorded lecture because I have another commitment. I cannot be there in the afternoon. But Nitika will be running the session, answering questions together with other graduate students that are helping us. Okay, so what is this? The other thing, I want you guys to, I want this to be as interactive as possible. This is not a YouTube video. I want to make this, you know, the closer to a lecture as it can be. I know it's not the same thing, but let's try. I want you guys to interrupt me every time you need a clarification and you have questions. So please interrupt me. You can unmute yourself. Don't raise your hands because I will not notice that the way my setup is. So just unmute yourself and interrupt me. Okay. All right, so let's start. So this course is about quantum information and quantum thermodynamics. So here we have three words that need some clarification for this course that are thermodynamics, information, and quantum. And I want to say a few words about these things before we start diving into more technical stuff. So I especially want to say something about thermodynamics, which is a subject that I always very much loved since the first time I met it, you know, already in high school. And it has grown on me. I always loved it, but it has grown on me, and maybe now it's my favorite subject in physics. I remember when you know, I was a student at your level, all the cool students, they were all studying, you know, the real cool physics, they would say, you know, something like relativity or quantum field theory or strings, all these things that they would say, hey, this is really the fundamental physics. Now, that's what is fundamental. That's why we want to be theorists, because we want to know what are the deepest mysteries of the universe. And thermodynamics, it's something that's a bit like engineering. It's something, okay, you want to make an engine, you want to make this engine more efficient. And also it's about many particles sort of together and their statistical behavior. So there is hardly anything fundamental to it. What is really fundamental is one particle all alone in the universe, at most interacting with a field, maybe the field of another particle. That's what is fundamental. And everything else is the Lego play with these building blocks, and we build from the bottom. And I really disagree with this point of view, because it is true that high energy physics deals with fundamental blocks. But thermodynamics, the fact that it's not dealing with the fundamental blocks doesn't mean that it's less fundamental. In fact, if anything, I want to argue that it's more fundamental. So thermodynamics is concerned not so much with, oh, how I can make a better engine. It's not, of course, this is an application of thermodynamics, but thermodynamics is not concerned with this question as the most important question. What thermodynamics is concerned with is this other question, which is a very cool question, is what is possible? So you see, quantum field theory tells you, oh, how some theory behaves. And you don't have only one elementary particles, you have many of them. But all of them have to be possible. They cannot violate thermodynamics, for instance. And you cannot have any conceivable quantum field theory or theory of space-time or theory of strings. There are limits to what is possible. Not everything is possible, which makes nature interesting, because if everything was equally possible, then what's the point? However, there is a very mysterious demarcation between what is possible and what is impossible. So we know, roughly speaking, that that you cannot violate conservation of energy in some sense, and especially you cannot have that entropy spontaneously decreases. This is impossible. And this is a way of thinking. It's not just about what happens in the thermal behavior of a system with many particles, but it is really the theory of the possible. This ties in very interestingly with information theory and quantum theory. So for information theory is a theory that has been developed starting from the end of the 19th century, but especially in 20th century. And initially, information theory was thought to be so abstract that it would be just a branch of math. Basically, information was thought to be these are the laws of thought, of some kind of organized mechanical thought, and there is no way that information theory could be any different. In fact, this is not the case. Information theory, because of the quantum information revolution, has taken the place, has basically experienced the same process that the geometry underwent at the beginning of the 20th century. Geometry was thought to be pure math. You have postulates. These postulates are true because they are, and everything else is deductive. And in fact, you know, with the discovery of non-Euclidean geometries first and then general relativity, after it was understood that geometry is not a branch of math, but a branch of physics. Physics tells you what kind of geometry you can have. And the same happens for information theory. If information is processed by classical physics, it follows some logical rules. But if it's processed by a quantum system, then it follows another type of rules that are the quantum rules. And because information theory is a modern way of understanding thermodynamics and what is possible, then quantum information theory is the theory of what is possible at the quantum level. And why this theory is so interesting is because we don't know. So although quantum mechanics has existed for, you know, more than 100 years, or let's say starting from its final formulation in 1925, you know, like 95 years or something like that, we know it's the right theory. So in this course, we take the point of view that we are not trying to make quantum mechanics better. It's already okay the way it is. But we don't know all that quantum mechanics is telling us. So specifically, we do not know all that is possible or impossible in quantum theory. For instance, this is a very important question, the question about Schrödinger cats. So we know that we don't usually experience macroscopic superpositions of cats being alive or dead. We have experimental evidence of spins one half being in a coherent superposition, right? You have things like this, but not this. Okay. And the question is why? So we know why this is almost always the case. It's because of the coherence, which is something that we will touch upon in these lectures. However, when we want to build a quantum computer, we actually want to build this. So this means that some of us don't believe that this is impossible. We just think that it's very, very, very hard. And people have shown that there are ways of doing that by constantly operating on the system to keep it alive, you know, not alive, but to keep it undead, you know, alive and dead at the same time. But there is an open question, and which is it possible to have a system that is kept in this state without any intervention from outside? Oh, we don't know. We don't know if this is possible or not. So this is just an example of what quantum thermodynamics is about. Okay, so after this introduction, let's start diving into the material. So we will start with some basic facts. Of quantum mechanics. And here what I will assume is that all of you are pretty familiar with the linear algebra, okay, but nothing else. So please interrupt me every time I say something that you're not familiar with. So let's start with our mathematical pillars. You know, our mathematical assumptions for what we need. So we need with a Hilbert space. And for us, whereas, you know, the Hilbert space is something that has very important properties about the convergence of sequences, we are only concerned with the finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. This means C to the power D. So C are the complex numbers, and D is the dimension of the Hilbert space. So this is just a vector space over the complex numbers. So we can also write it by finding an orthonormal basis as the span, which means the set of all the possible linear combinations over the complex numbers of D vectors that are orthonormal between each other. This is also what is called in physics a D-level system. Okay, so this is our basic mathematical structure. I will use the ket notation, and these objects are vectors in the Hilbert space H. Okay. The next object that we need are linear operators. So linear operators are mappings between H and H that are linear. And given a basis in the Hilbert space, so a basis like this one, so we have kets that are labeled by I. In this basis, a linear operator reads the sum over I and j of some complex numbers that are the matrix elements, and then you have ket I bra j. Are you familiar with the ket and bra notation? I hope so.
Yes.
Very good. Okay, so this is what a linear operator is. Let's go ahead. And among linear operators, there are some particular linear operators that are called positive, actually semi-definite positive, which means that for every vector in the Hilbert space, if you take this object, which is a complex number, well, this is gonna be actually a real number greater or equal than zero. Okay, for all vectors. And then there are Hermitian operators that are those such that A dagger is equal to A. And Hermitian operators have a very important property, is that they have a spectral resolution. This means that they have special vectors called the eigenvectors that are also a basis in the Hilbert space, such that A can be written as the sum over the eigenvalues times the projectors onto these eigenvectors. So these objects here, ket bra, is a projector. And I will write something like this. And here I will put a superscript A to remind us, oh, this is the projector, the set of projectors defined by our Hermitian operator A. Okay. Another important thing in math that we need is the concept of norm. Okay, so these are called Schatten norms, P norms. And so you know in linear algebra what a norm is something that defines, you know, the size of an algebraic object. And they have all these properties like the triangular inequality and the Cauchy-Schwarz and so on. But SHAT and P norms are defined in this way. So we have an operator, the P norm of this object is defined as the P root of the trace of a dagger A to the power P over 2. So this means that first take a dagger A, then I take the power P over 2, then I take the trace, and then I take the P root. Examples for P equal 1, you have the so-called trace norm. And so the or one norm, the one norm of A is just the trace of the square root of a dagger A. The P2 is sometimes called Frobenius norm. And A2 is equal to the square root of the trace of a dagger A. You can see that if the operator is Hermitian, this is the square root of the trace of A square, right? Because A dagger is equal to A. And another interesting one is P infinity. This is the operator norm, which is the one that you probably know, which is the way of evaluating the norm of an operator by trying it on vectors. So I take A, I operate it on a vector. So now I have another vector. Now this is the norm of the vector. It's the Euclidean norm. Then I divide by the norm of the vector. And then I take the sup of this over all the vectors. This is the operator norm. Okay, so operators whose norm is finite are called bounded operators. And bounded operators will be denoted by this symbol, calligraphic B on H. Okay, so this is the math that we need for now. And now let's see physics. So what is quantum mechanics? So let's say quantum mechanics in one slide. Let's see if I manage.
Okay. Sorry for interruption. Could you return to the previous page?
Sure.
And here in the definition of the operation norm, we found sub of norm of A on C. Which norm is used here under the sub?
Oh, this one? Or this one? This is the same norm. It's the norm on vectors. It's the one given by the inner product.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So one is using the norm on vectors to define the norm on operators in the operator norm. Okay, so quantum mechanics in one slide. What are states? First of all, we have two types of objects. We have states and observables. States are Hermitian operators that are positive. I'm writing positive, but I mean semi-definite positive. This means this. Okay. So these are operators, okay? Such that their trace is one. Okay, so this is what states are Hermitian positive operators with the trace one. They represent our physical system. How they represent a physical system? In this way, given a measurement that we can make, they help us out understanding what type of outcomes we can get. So a measurement is also described by another Hermitian operator, let me call it A, and let me write it in its spectral resolution. We know this spectral resolution exists because of what we just said. Okay?
Sorry, Can I interrupt? So the states themselves are operators, you're saying?
Yep.
Okay, so we're not just taking them as some abstract ket. We're taking...
It's an operator.
Okay.
Okay, so let's see how these operators tells us anything about the outcomes of an experiment that, you know, is described by an Hermitian operator A. So the eigenvalues of the spectral resolutions are the possible outcomes of the measurement. So it's a fact of nature that when you measure A, you have a set of possible outcomes and nothing else. And the set of possible outcomes are taken to be the eigenvalues of an Hermitian operator. And as you know, quantum mechanics is a probabilistic theory. This means that the outcome AI cannot be predicted. All you can predict is the probability of the outcome AI. And this probability depends on the state of the system and on what you're measuring. And the probability of the outcome AI is given by the trace of psi pi. Okay, this is quantum mechanics. I would need one more line, but I just don't want to write it in this slide. I could fit it in this slide if I wanted to describe the time evolution. But I don't want to do it just yet. So with the exception of time evolution, these are the rules of quantum mechanics. There is nothing else. So everything else is just the application of a probability theory. So since we know that we have the outcome AI, and now let me call this just PI, is this probability, with the probability PI, then you know things like, oh, what is the expectation value of my measurement of A is gonna be equal to the sum of all the outcomes with their probability. If I want to know, oh, what is the expectation value of A squared, which you know we need to understand the variance of our measurements, then this will be just this, and so on and so forth. So you can compute all you want. I remind you that the variance of, it's ugly, the variance of a distribution of values that are the results of your experiments, let me call it delta A square, is just the expectation value of A square minus the expectation value of A, and now this one is squared. It's a simple exercise, I'm sure you've done it, that this is greater or equal than zero. It just basically a property of powers. Okay, do you have questions on this? Okay, let's see what is the difference. So when we have a state psi, remember I can write it. So a state psi, I said, it's an Hermitian operator that is positive and it has a trace one. So because it's Hermitian, I can write it's a spectral resolution, right? And now I have some projectors that are orthonormal, just like I did for A. This is Hermitian, so also it has its eigenvectors and its eigenvalues. However, you see that because psi is greater or equal than zero, then the PIs also must be greater or equal than zero. Can you see that?
sorry, I have a question. We told that psi belongs to the Hilbert space that is complex. So we told that psi a matrix?
No, this is a complex vector. So this belongs to the Hilbert space. But psi is a bounded positive trace one operator, Hermitian operator on the Hilbert space. These are vectors. These are states. States are operators. Okay?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, and it's part of the definition of being a state that this is true. Okay, it's a sum operator that is positive. But because it's Hermitian, it does have a spectral resolution. And now my contention is that these numbers must be greater or equal than zero. Can you see why this is the case? You know, so let's say that I want to compute PL. A way to compute PL, as you can see from this expression, is to take this. Do you agree? But because psi is a positive operator, this must be greater or equal than zero. Okay. And we also said that the trace of psi is equal to one. And by using the same type of trick, right, the trace of psi is gonna be just the sum of all these objects. So you see that the eigenvalues of a state are numbers that are greater or equal than zero, so they are positive real numbers with the sum of one. In other words, they are a probability distribution. Okay. Now, you are all used to the fact that states are vectors that are normalized. And that the probability of having the outcome I is equal to the modulus square of your state times the eigenvector of the operator that you're measuring. And also that the expectation value of A is equal to this. This is what you're used to. Okay? Now, another thing. Imagine that I give you not just one state, but I don't know what state I'm giving you, right? I'm giving you a set of possible states, psi L, that are orthonormal. This means, so, you know, they are very different states because they're orthonormal. So they have no component one on the other. And I give you this state with some probability QL. Okay, so you see, I have a distribution of probability over the states. And now you ask, okay, if I want to know what is the expectation value of A given this distribution, right? I have all these states with the probability QL. What I would do? I would say, okay, so let me compute the expectation value of L, of A, sorry, when I'm given the states psi L Well, this is the expectation value of L, given that I got this one. Oh, but this comes with a probability QL. So the expectation value, if my state is given by this distribution, is just the sum with the probabilities of each correspondent expectation value. Okay, so this is what you are used to. Now let's go back to our expression for a state written as in its spectral resolution. You will do as an exercise, so it's something that you will do in a few minutes, that things like, oh, the expectation value of A, which we have defined as the trace of whatever is my, oh, this is, yeah, the trace of psi with my projector AL. So this is what we said before, is actually equal to exactly the thing that we wrote before. So you see that this formula describes exactly this concept that you somehow are already familiar with. So this is the state seen as a vector, but it's given with some probability QL, then how do I find the expectation values and other things? Well, use the formula that we said. So you will do this as an exercise so that you will see how these things are connected. In the particular case that we're given only one specific state, right? This means that you have one specific psi tilde L with probability one, and so QL is equal to one, and all the others are zero. In which case our formula reduces to just that state.
Pardon?
Yep.
So on the previous slide.
Yep.
I'm just struggling to read what you've written in the brackets of the trace there. Is that psi acting on AL?
Yeah, this is so ugly. I'm very sorry. Let me
rewrite. It's all right. So QL now is our density of states, right?
So psi is our state, and AL, cat, AL bra, is the projector onto the eigenvector AL of the operator A. Remember how we wrote A, right? A was equal to the sum of its eigenvalues, and then you had its eigenvectors. And cat bra is a projector. Make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Little unused to writing states as operators, but all right.
Yeah, that's why this is a new class. So you will get used to new stuff. And I need to stop just for a second because I don't know what they're doing here. Okay. Can you see everything again? So they're making a lot of noise here in my neighborhood. It's really annoying. All right. So we were saying that if your probability distribution over the states, so let me start again. We can give the state psi L with a probability QL. So I have this probability distribution. And this produces a state seen as an operator that is QL psi L psi L. Okay? And we just said that if this probability distribution is extremal, means say is 1, 0, 0, 0, this means that the first one has probability 1 and the other ones have probability 0, or the one can be anywhere in the middle. Let me put the first place just for the sake of it. Then psi is just equal to psi 1, right? Because Q1 is 1 and all the other terms are 0. This is what you call a pure state. So a state is pure when you have only one probability being 1 and all the probabilities being 0. Every time you have a non-trivial probability distribution, then you have a non-pure state, right? For instance, let me give an example. So if you imagine the Hilbert space of a qubit, which is the span of just the two states that we can call 0 and 1. Okay, so I could have a state psi could be, with probability 1/2, I have the state 0. And with probability 1/2, I have the state 1. Okay, now this is not pure. If the probability of having 0 is 1, then I would have just this one. Okay, let me go back to this one example. Is there a way of quantifying how much a state is pure or non-pure? Well, the answer is yes. And again, it's a simple property of powers. So let me write again our state. Now you will notice that whereas the sum over all these numbers must be 1, the sum of all these numbers to a power alpha with alpha greater than 1 must be smaller or equal than 1. And it is 1 if and only if one of the PI is 1 and all the others are 0. That is when the state is pure. So if we choose alpha equal 2, we call this quantity purity of the state, purity. And you will prove as an exercise that this object is smaller than 1 and always greater than 1 over D. Remember, what is this? The dimension of the Hilbert space. This is called purity. Okay. You will prove this and many other interesting statements about this quantity.
So what we have to prove in the exercise is the purity?
Yes. There are, in the exercises, there are things about purity and about von Neumann entropy and other things. Okay. Another thing that you should be familiar with, which is very important, is the notion of composite systems. What happens if I have not just one qubit, which is the span of 0 and 1, which is what we call C2, but we have two of them. Okay, so we have another system that is another C2. Which is another spin 1/2. Well, in this case, the system of two spins will be the tensor product of the two vector spaces. And I trust that you know what this is. Okay? And in general, if we have a tensor product of many spins, say capital M spins, we denote this by C2 tensor of power capital M. This is a definition. Okay. Tensor products are not complicated. You just give a basis of a tensor product is just the product, the tensor product of basis in each of the factors. Okay, so this is gonna be the span of these objects. So these objects, you can sum them, you can take linear combinations, therefore they make a vector space. Okay. Oh, it's already 10:46. So let me go overboard. This is gonna happen a lot. Sorry. But because at the very least, I want to show you this argument, which is the, you know, one of the most important things of this course. And the argument is, what is entropy? So this is basically due to von Neumann that thought of this thought experiment. So imagine that we have n particles. So each one is described by some VI level system. Okay, so the total Hilbert space is just the tensor product of these ones. For the sake of simplicity, this could be, this could be, exempli gratiae, just many spins one off, okay, many qubits. And let's consider the state of each of these particles in some pure state. So it is some superposition of the basis states with some amplitudes. Okay, so you see here we have a label I that is labeling the I particle belonging to the ith Hilbert space. And I will represent each of these particles as a dot. Imagine we put all these particles in a box. And let me divide this box in two. Right now, the right part of the box is empty, and we have all these particles in the box. And we place them all in the same state. Okay? So we, for instance, to make examples, if every particle is a C2, we say that the I particle is just 1/√2, the spin up plus the spin down. And each of them is in this state. And the particles are non-interacting. So my total state is still a pure state, is the tensor product of all these ones. Okay. I will say, I will just declare that the entropy of this state is zero. So as you know, entropy in thermodynamics is a potential. This means that you can actually just compute difference of these potentials, right? So you have to get a starting point that you declare it to have entropy zero, and this is our starting point. So you have this quantum gas of non-interacting particles, and it has zero entropy. Okay, so now we do something. we measure these particles, and we, what is that we measure? We want to measure whether they are in the state plus, this means we have the we check this projector, or if they're in the state minus, means that we check this projector, right? And so some of these particles, after, let me draw my box again, some of them will be plus, are these ones, and some of them will be minus. And if I want to know the number of pluses, it will be equal to the number of total number of particles times the probability of being plus, which, as you remember, is the modulus square of that amplitude. In this case, it's 1/2, right? This is both W plus and W minus, because we chose them to be equal. And then minus is the same thing. Very good. So you see this, if I want to use my notation, means that my state psi prime now is equal to let me write it like this. After the measurement, my state psi will be equal to W plus minus square the projector on plus, which is this. Plus W, okay, this plus. The probability of being minus times the projector minus. So you see, our state that was pure initially now is mixed after the measurement. And whatever is the entropy of the state after the measurement, we call it S2. And we would like to understand what is S2 minus S1, how much the entropy changed because of this measurement. So how do we do that? So von Neumann thought of this, said, imagine that my box is made in this way. So there is here a wall that is movable and it is a semi-transparent. And here I have two walls. One is semi-transparent, but it's fixed. And the other one is impermeable and also can be moved. And here I have all my particles. And what von Neumann was thinking is, let's move these walls, the ones that can be moved, at the very slowly, at the same pace, so that the volume of this box that is moving is constant. What does it mean, semi-permeable? Means that it goes across the plus, these are the plus particles, but it pushes away the minus particles. So after I moved all the walls on the other side, I will be left with this situation. Here I have the semi-permeable thing that now cannot be crossed anymore. And here I have only these particles, and here I have only these particles. Okay. Notice that in this process, the system has been kept completely isolated from the environment, and no work has been made. So both Q and W are zero. So nothing happened to the gas. Okay, and everything is reversible. Very good. At this point, so I see some things in the chat, but I cannot read the chat. So can you interrupt me if you have something to say?
Can I actually, that question is very previous, so we can catch on it later.
So, sorry, can you repeat, please?
That question is related to a very early topic, so we can catch on it later.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm saying that the question I asked is related to something which was covered very early, so we can catch on it later.
Okay, great. All right, so let me finish this argument by phenomenon because it's actually very, very instructive. Okay, so you see, we have separated the gases and we have not communicated with the environment yet. Now, at this point, we communicate with the environment. We do an isothermal compression.
Sorry, Alyosha, I think that Kofi is raising his hand.
Yeah, Kofi, please. And please do not raise your hands because I cannot see them. Just interrupt me. Kofi, go ahead.
I would like you to come back on the previous last part when you were talking about the entropy, but you were not, the last part when you draw the box and you write down the state. Yeah, I don't really get the explanation this part.
Yeah, okay. So all I'm saying is that we want to know what entropy is. Okay, we don't know what is the entropy of a quantum state. So von Neumann said, okay, let's argue this way. Let me say that I start with a pure state and then I make a measurement. Okay, and now I want to try to compute the change of entropy in this state. And if I can compute it using some argument, this will define my notion of entropy. So how do we go about that? We first say, we must declare that the entropy of the initial state is zero. That's fine, because this is what we do with entropy anyway. We only define variations of entropy. And now we make a measurement and we will say, now we have a new state after the measurement. Now the new state is this one, right, after the measurement. Before, it was this one. Now it's this one. And now we have a new entropy, so we have this delta S, which is equal S2 minus S1. And if we need to compute this entropy, and this computation will define what the quantum entropy is, okay? So now I'm proceeding to find an argument to compute this entropy. And von Neumann will argue like this, say, hey, this is a gas. So let me do some stuff to it. And then I can compute the thermodynamic entropy. And I will use that as a definition of a quantum entropy. Okay, so that's the logic. So what is that we do? We have this gas here like this. And now we make it, we separate the two species. And we can do that with these movable semi-permeable walls. And the important remark here is that the environment didn't do any work and didn't exchange any heat with our gas. Okay? But now we do an isothermal compression. So now the environment is communicating with our system, right? Because we're making a compression, so there is heat and work involved. But it's the first time that the environment is exchanging something with our gas. And each of these gases, notice that it is at the volume V. Okay? And now we compress the two gases, and the first gas, the plus gases, the one that is on the left, this one is plus, this one is minus, will be compressed to V prime plus. We can compress it to a fraction of the initial volume, and let the fraction be this. And the same for the minus one. Okay. So now we did something with the environment. Okay. And so there were two compressions. In these two compressions, the two gases exchanged work and the heat with the environment. And I'm asking, what is the variation of entropy in the environment in this process? Well, it will be the variation in the environment due to the compression of, this is the one for the environment, due to the compression of the plus gas, plus the one due to the compression of the minus gas. Well, and now you just need to remember your physics one, and you must remember that this is equal to minus and plus K log of V prime plus over V, and minus and plus K log of V prime minus over V. This is just ordinary thermodynamics for the isothermal compression. The minus comes from the fact that I'm not computing the entropy of the gas. I'm computing the entropy of the change of entropy of the environment. But
I'm sorry. I think for the second term, perhaps you meant N minus.
Yes.
Cool.
Thank you. Great, thanks. Now remember that N plus minus was equal to W plus minus square N, and that V minus, V prime plus minus was this. And you will get that the total change of entropy is equal to minus NK W plus square log W plus square minus NK W minus square log W minus square. Okay. Interesting. So this is the variation of entropy in the environment. Okay, now what do I do? Now, since I have these gases that are separated, so these are plus gases, these are minus gases. Now I do a unitary rotation, means, okay, so the state of this gas is plus plus. I can, by means of a rotation, which is just a unitary operator, make it again W1 plus W, sorry, W plus W minus. And I do it for every particle. This is also a reversible operation because unitary operators have an inverse. This means that after I do it for everyone, so I also do it for this one, I am exactly in the initial state. Okay? So now, because everything was reversible, every transformation I did was reversible, this means that the delta S of the environment plus the delta S of the state is equal to zero, because the total system, state plus environment, this is the gas, sorry, I should say gas. is isolated, so there is no change of entropy because these are all reversible transformations. So this means that the delta S of the environment is equal to minus the delta S of the gas. And the delta S of the gas is equal to, this one is equal to S1 minus S2. With a minus. So this means that the entropy S2 is actually equal to the entropy of the environment, which is this formula that we wrote, minus nk w plus square log w plus square plus w minus square log w minus square. And this expression is called Feynman entropy. It can be generalized. Let me write here the general formula. So the entropy of a state psi is equal minus n k the sum over I w I square log w I square. This is the Feynman entropy. Now you will solve many problems now on the Feynman entropy. For instance, show that the Feynman entropy of a pure state is equal to zero, or show that the Feynman entropy of the state that is the identity over D is equal to log D, and it's the maximum value that the entropy can have. And also there is something called Rényi entropy, S alpha, it is defined in this way. And show the properties of this other type of entropy. And the limit of alpha going to one is the Feynman entropy. Okay, so it's all for now. I went a lot overboard. So I can stop now, and now we can go to the break rooms and start working together.
Sorry, where do we?
Now, Beata is in charge.
So maybe do you have some questions to Alyosha before we?
Oh, yeah, yeah, let's do questions. I like that.
Just where is the problem set?
Where is the problem set?
Yeah, you gave some problems during the lecture. Is there a sheet that we can look at that contains them?
Yeah, so there is. So I was hoping that you guys were taking notes.
Yes, of course.
Because I do have a handout, but the handout is with the solutions. So I can do two things. Either I give you the handout with the solutions, or you real time, let me comment away the solutions and make a new handout, like right now. Okay, so I'm going to give you the handout. You're right. I don't know why I didn't do that.
Do you have more questions about the lecture?
Yeah. Do you have questions?
Okay. If not...
I didn't understand the last two expressions of entropy. You said that it was phenomena entropy. So those are the last one was a variation of the
Okay. So there are other entropies. It's a family of entropies called the Rényi entropies. They have similar mathematical properties, but they are not the thermodynamic entropy. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
And we want to understand also those entropies, but the phenomenon entropy is like the thermodynamic entropy for the reasons that we explained. Okay.
There's one question in the problem set about this entropy, so I think it will help to clarify what was introduced in the lecture.
So what's the